This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we begin today with the latest in the process to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. In emotional testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee last week, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford revealed the details of her accusations of sexual assault against Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh. The FBI is now looking into those allegations and other reports of excessive drinking by Kavanaugh, and they have 1 week to complete the task. After that, senators will vote on whether to confirm the judge to the highest court in the land. For her part, Dr. Ford told the senators that she was positive about the events she remembers back in the summer of 1982.
With what degree of certainty do you believe Brett Kavanaugh assaulted you?
100%.
Judge Kavanaugh, however, firmly denied the allegations.
None of these allegations are true.
Correct.
No doubt in your mind.
Zero. I'm 100% certain.
At the urging of Democrats and three Republican senators, the White House ordered the FBI to perform a limited additional investigation on Kavanaugh. But Democrats argue that the FBI's scope is too narrow. The FBI was directed by the White House and Senate Republicans to interview just four people, including a second accuser, Deborah Ramirez. Here's the president speaking to the press over the weekend.
I would expect it's going to turn out very well for the judge. There's never been anybody that's been looked at like Judge Kavanaugh. I think that it's going to work out very well, but the FBI, I believe, is doing a really great job. They have been all over already.
And the president said that the White House has not limited the FBI's scope.
Yeah, they have free rein. They're going to do whatever they have to do, whatever it is they do. They'll be doing things that we never even thought of. And hopefully at the conclusion, everything will be fine.
We now turn to two people who understand exactly what it takes for the FBI to investigate allegations of this magnitude. Jerry Williams is a retired FBI agent and host of the FBI Retired Case File Review podcast. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you. And we're also joined by Brad Moss, a national security lawyer who represents people within the intelligence community who are going through FBI background investigations and addressing security clearance actions. Hi, Brad.
How are you doing today?
I'm well. Thank you both for joining us. Jerry, let's start with you. We've heard a lot about an investigation, but what kind of investigation are we talking about? I've heard it described as a supplemental background check. Can you help us understand?
Right. These are normal parts of the FBI. We do background investigations for federal judgeships. I've actually, during my career, been assigned as the case agent on a federal judgeship case. They're called SPIN investigations, special inquiries. And so this is not anything new. This is what the FBI, you know, a lot of people don't realize that, but this is part of what the FBI does.
And just to be clear, Jerry, what is it that the FBI is looking for in this special investigation?
They're basically gathering all the information about a person's background to assess whether or not that person is able to be granted a top secret security clearance. And so they're looking for anything that would deny them that ability to get that clearance. So they're interviewing employers, they're interviewing neighbors, they're interviewing friends, they're looking at medical records, educational records, you know, just trying to assess this person's background. That's already been done for Judge Kavanaugh.
And so our understanding, Jerry, is that they're only allowed to, the FBI has been directed to just speak to four people. And those people, as we understand it, are Mark Judge, whose name came up repeatedly in last week's hearings, PJ Smith, a high school friend of Brett Kavanaugh's, Leland Kaiser, a friend of Dr. Ford's from high school, and of course, Deborah Ramirez, who we've heard a lot about. Why is it limited to these four people?
I have no idea whether that's correct or not. I did just hear your soundbite from President Trump, where he said that they're all over the place already, which would indicate to me that they've done more than just these four interviews. But I can understand the wording of limited in scope, because again, the background investigation, for the most part, has already been completed. So they don't need to redo the background investigation, but they do need to assess the allegations that have been brought forth right now. So it is limited in the sense that they're just looking at those. But for any FBI investigation, whether it's a criminal investigation, which this is not, or a background investigation, agents are going to follow the path where the investigation takes them. So if they conduct these initial four interviews and they find that there are additional leads that need to be set, I am sure that that information will be given to the White House, and I'm sure that the FBI will be allowed to continue their investigation.
I'm speaking with Jerry Williams, a retired FBI agent, and Brad Moss, a national security attorney, about the FBI investigation into Brett Kavanaugh. Brad, I want to bring you in here. What's your take on the scope of this investigation?
Yeah, so I mean, I have some concerns, and obviously, as Jerry noted, we have some kind of conflicting reports here on just how limited or not limited this probe is going to be. So the way I've seen it from my end, as the private attorney, is that if new, you know, adverse and credible information has arisen that forces the FBI to reopen the probe, once they've gathered those peripheral details, depending on the circumstances, and here it'd be gathering statements from these other individuals who are talking about the extent to which Brett Kavanaugh and Mark Judge were, you know, used to drink a lot back in their high school and college days, getting the statements from people like Ms. Ramirez and possibly Ms. Swetnick, that gives a lot of the peripheral context. That's where I have seen some re-interviews done of people who had already been interviewed in the past as part of these background checks, really just to kind of address these discrepancies that have popped up. I mean, in the end, you know, the basic background check is kind of like very much just on the surface. It's whatever they've already had reported by the individual who's being investigated, as well as whatever has been documented in such as like a criminal history. And with Judge Kavanaugh, there was no obvious criminal record tied to these issues, so they may not have come up. It wouldn't have been something they necessarily would have found in the initial background check. But now that these additional details have come up, those are the kind of situations where I've seen that the FBI will do some re-interviews, not trying to, you know, get people caught up in a Perry Mason, Law and Order type moment, but try to resolve the discrepancies in the factual record and see if it produces new leads.
Well, we obviously, the FBI has been given a week to complete this investigation. Brad, is that enough time, in your opinion?
It depends on whether or not we're putting form over function. I don't think Jerry would ever have liked the idea of having a, you know, very strict time frame put on her ability to conduct an investigation. The investigation goes where it goes. I certainly think the FBI has the resources and the competence and expertise to do it within a week if they want. But I'd be concerned if there are, in fact, additional leads that come out of this. If there is a need for additional interviews and additional investigation, whether or not this arbitrary time frame is going to restrict the ability of the FBI to truly do its job here.
Jerry, your thoughts on that? I mean, as Brad mentioned, as a former FBI agent yourself, is a week enough time?
I believe so for the initial investigation. Again, as Brad mentioned, you know, if there are leads that are developed from this, or if there are people that they weren't able to contact, maybe somebody was out of the country or unavailable, you know, there may be a few leads that cannot be addressed, but if all of that, it does not occur, you know, if everybody's available, then yes, they can complete it in time. Remember, the FBI is used to deadlines. They're used to short deadlines involving life and death situations such as hostage takings and kidnappings. And, you know, our system of setting leads for our agents throughout the country and our 56 field offices and our several hundred resident agencies is well-oiled machine. So if leads need to be made, as soon as they get the information and they coordinate that with headquarters, additional leads will be set and they'll be completed, you know, as quickly as possible.
Brad, and I'm wondering, you know, obviously these types of claims are really difficult to investigate. We're talking about something that took place in 1982. What do you think the FBI is looking for to corroborate any of these claims? And what happens if they find out that this is, in fact, true?
Well, some of it comes into these peripheral details, some of which you heard in Dr. Ford's testimony, trying to corroborate issues like, you know, the circumstance which she ran into Mark Judge at the Safeway, you know, a few weeks after, something they can verify, they can request employment records from a corporation like that, presumably with Mr. Judge's consent. I mean, there's a lot of peripheral details they could probe, they could try to pull documentation on, they could try to re-interview some of the relevant parties that would have known Judge Kavanaugh, would have known Dr. Ford about the circumstances of this particular time frame in 1982, just to get additional details. But it really depends here, again, on how in-depth they want to truly run this probe, or if this is just going to be something that's done on the surface, that's really just trying to placate the lawmakers who've raised concerns about a due process issue, and whether or not they are truly going to try to get down to the nitty-gritty details, or if this is just an idea of trying to get everything done within the auspices of the FBI asking instead of just Congress.
Jerry, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that, because I think that's a point that comes up with this, is a week enough time? We've said that, yes, for the FBI, that could be or should be enough time. But what else? Is this really just a show, or are we expecting to find something that could move this conversation forward? And if we do, then what happens?
Well, I don't think anybody's expecting to find anything. They're just going out to gather the information. The FBI would not be looking for anything in particular. They're just going to be talking to people. And if they develop something, then they're going to proceed with that. And remember, this is not a criminal investigation. So any records that we're looking for, as Brad mentioned, are going to be obtained through a release form where the person who those records are about will release the company that has those records so that we can look at them. There'll be no subpoenas issued.
Brad, any last thoughts from you?
Yeah, I agree. They're not going to make a finding of this. You know, these allegations were credible or not. They're just going to outline all the details of what they found, and it's up to the White House and the Senate to decide where to go next.
That's Jerry Williams, retired FBI agent and host of the FBI Retired Case Review podcast, and Brad Moss, a national security lawyer. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, it's your turn. Over the weekend, a lot of you called us to weigh in on the Supreme Court confirmation process of Judge Brett Kavanaugh.
Clemente Vera from Miami, Florida. Why wait all this time? She could have brought that up when he was judge anytime. I'm going to tell you why she waited till this time, because this was the biggest audience. I guarantee you in a month, 2 months, there's going to be a book out for her. This is a money-making scheme.
If only Judge Kavanaugh had been honest and stated that he could not remember what he did or did not do, that would have shown some integrity and some character.
My name is Lynn. I'm calling from Saugus, Massachusetts. And I really don't think that Dr. Blasey Ford proved her case. She seemed very unconfident to me. On the other hand, I feel that Brett Kavanaugh seemed very confident and very passionate.
Hi, this is Melanie from Sarasota, Florida. I'm pretty sure he's going to end up on the Supreme Court. And the sad thing for our nation is that most men of power don't believe that what he did was assault. And that's why it's going to be okay in everybody's mind, but not ours. Not the women who've been victimized in the past and who are raising, hopefully, sons who will never do that again.
Hi, my name is Pat. I'm calling from San Francisco, California. I do not understand why we seem to think that Judge Kavanaugh deserves this promotion. Somebody who yells and screams and talks back to female senators, he does not have the temperament, the humility, the empathy to be the face of our country, both to Americans and to others around the world.
Reached the National Sexual Assault Hotline, operated by RAIN. To reach a hotline staff member in your area, please press 1 now. If you are a member of the U.S. military or are calling about someone who is, please press 2 now to be connected to the DOD Safe Helpline.
Last week, the National Sexual Assault Hotline, run by the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, or RAIN, got what they called an unprecedented surge in calls. The increase came during the marathon Senate hearing last Thursday, where Dr. Christine Blasey Ford recounted her story of sexual assault in front of a national audience. Patricia Teffenhardt is the executive director of the New Jersey Coalition Against Sexual Assault, which helps to manage the state's part of the national hotline. Patricia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So we are talking about, over the past week, we've seen an increase, a 201% increase in calls to the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, or RAIN. What is it about what we're witnessing that sparks these types of calls, this increase?
You know, we see this often when there are high-profile cases, that they're highly triggering for survivors. Survivors who maybe have never disclosed their victimization to anyone. And now, as conversations daily are bombarding them about acts of sexual violence and sometimes very graphic images pop up in their heads, and they're feeling almost re-victimized. Sometimes that's what's compelling them to call a hotline. Sometimes survivors are calling hotlines because they're feeling empowered by the national conversation, and they know how underreported this crime is. We know how the underreporting of this particular crime impacts laws and policies and the national dialogue, and survivors feel compelled to contribute their story to that conversation to highlight the impact and prevalence. And there are so many different reasons why survivors take advantage or feel compelled to reach out for help during these national conversations, but it's been happening since, you know, the election in 2016, and it doesn't really seem to stop.
And is it also, are you hearing from callers who are saying potentially they didn't know that what they experienced was sexual assault, and now with the sort of focus on this conversation today, they're recognizing that it might have been? Are there folks who didn't understand the severity of what they'd been through?
Yes, absolutely. Oftentimes, one survivor's story, once it gets picked up by the media or we start to have a national conversation about it, other survivors start to identify elements of that story that relate very much to what they experienced. And particularly as I think we're going through a major culture shift in this country, that's really highlighting all the different ways in which we are impacted by forms of violence all along the spectrum, from workplace sexual harassment to sexual assault itself. I think survivors are recognizing parts of their story and that of others. There was a Department of Justice study some years ago that said roughly 18% of survivors don't tell anyone of what happened to them simply because it didn't feel big enough or important enough. But survivors are feeling compelled to tell their story now as part of a national conversation that is incredibly important, especially if they're looking at the potential of their perpetrator to move into a position of power that could influence the lives of many other community members.
What happens on a call like this?
For the most part, whoever is answering the hotline responds to the expressed needs and desires of the caller. So some survivors are calling simply because they want someone to affirm for them that what they experienced was in fact sexual assault. Sometimes they're calling because they'd like to be looped into counseling services. A lot of people call hotlines because they're looking for information about the criminal or civil statute of limitations in their state. And there's a large number of callers that I think don't get a lot of attention, and those are loved ones of people who have disclosed their survivorship. A loved one who is perhaps now for the first time learning that their son or daughter or even their mother was victimized some years ago, and wanting to reach out to experts to help them navigate those waters so that they can help that person along their journey of healing.
You know, what's interesting is also you mentioned the statute of limitations, and each state has its own statute for sexual assault. But I'm wondering what happens, you know, we've been listening to calls also from people who have experienced sexual assault many, many, many years ago, very early in their lives, and are now coming to terms with it. When the statute of limitations has expired, if you didn't know to do a rape kit, for example, what can someone do who is now reckoning with having been the victim of sexual assault, who is outside of the statute of limitations, who didn't take the steps that they thought might have, you know, helped them to navigate this situation when it happened?
You know, I think the answer to that question is really one that has very little to do with the survivors or victims and more with our policymakers. As I think we're noticing with high-profile cases like Bill Cosby, for example, so many survivors had come forward and were denied opportunities to pursue justice simply because the statute of limitations had expired in their state. And so I think that this should be a time of reckoning for those that are in positions to shift policy, to affirm what we now know about the impact of this trauma. And the FBI recognizes sexual assault as the second most violent crime. The first most violent crime is murder. And when we have survivors who are now coming to terms with what happened to them many years ago, to deny them opportunities to pursue justice because we have laws on the books that are not trauma-informed or survivor-centered at this point in time, given what we've been talking about pretty much consistently for at least the last 2 years, is not acceptable.
So we've talked about what people can do at the policy level and within the legal system, but what should they do? I mean, I feel like what's happening for a lot of women across the country and men who have been victims of sexual assault and sexual misconduct is there seems to be a real psychological toll that's being taken on Americans across the country. It's very exhausting to have to listen to this for some people. It's opening up new wounds for others. They're revisiting places that they may not have wanted to revisit. What's the best course of action for dealing with this sort of re-traumatization, if you will, the psychological heaviness that comes with having to have this conversation day in and day out?
Oh, that is a question that hits home. For survivors, I think it's really just listening to their own bodies. As we just started this conversation, so many new survivors or survivors who are just now reconciling their victimization or reaching out for help through professional hotlines, and that's critically important. But for some survivors, that might not be the path that they wish to pursue. They still may not be ready to acknowledge to anyone that they've experienced this crime. And so self-care is critically important right now. If you have the privilege of being able to take some paid time off to care for yourself, that's a great thing to pursue. If you have an opportunity to take some extended breaks and be one with nature and smell the roses and go for a walk, if physical activity is a good stress reliever for you, and to realize that as a nation, we have embarked upon a marathon of culture change. This is certainly not a sprint. Culture change work takes generations to have an impact. And so it's okay for survivors to sort of pass the baton for a while. And I hope that survivors realize that they are being held close to our hearts as we do this work and have these conversations, and that it is not their individual responsibility to change the culture. Their responsibility is to be as well and as healthy as they can be.
Patricia Teffenhardt is the executive director of the New Jersey Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And a reminder to our listeners, if you are a survivor of sexual violence and need to talk to someone, the national hotline is 1-800-656-4673. Patricia, thanks for being on The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, Babbel.com, or download the app to try it for free. Babbel.com.
There are a few people who are considered larger than life, and Cristiano Ronaldo is one of them. The Portuguese soccer player is among the greatest athletes and top soccer players in the world and among the highest paid. In countries where soccer is like religion, he's a prophet-like figure. But this weekend, a 2009 rape allegation resurfaced. In a scathing article in Germany's Der Spiegel magazine, an American woman named Catherine Mayorga is speaking out for the first time. She told the magazine that Ronaldo raped and assaulted her in a hotel in Las Vegas in 2009. At the time, she said she went to the police and even got examined by medical professionals. Ultimately, she agreed to an out-of-court settlement for $375,000. But now she's coming forward with her full story, and she has the lawsuit documents to prove it, some of which are signed by Ronaldo himself. Ronaldo denies the allegations and has called the story, quote-unquote, fake news. His lawyers have said that they will sue the magazine. Joining me now to discuss this is Shireen Ahmed, freelance sports writer and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Shireen, thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thank you for having me, Tanzina.
We need some of your guidance on this story here. So let's go over the basics of this. Who is the woman in question, Catherine Mayorga, and how did she and Ronaldo first meet?
Well, Kevin Mayorga is actually from Las Vegas, Nevada. At the time, she was 25, and we're talking about this occurred in 2009. She was working at a nightclub, and she was an aspiring model slash actress. And he was there. This was just before he was going to be traded to Manchester United. So he was there to party with his posse, I guess you could say, his entourage. So he, according to the Der Spiegel article and her account, he noticed her, pulled her aside, and she wasn't really sure who he was. She had heard of him. I mean, who hadn't heard of him, but she wasn't sure. And then he got her number, texted her, and invited her to a party. And the details, and just a trigger warning for anyone listening, he was very aggressive. He brutally assaulted her. And even in the account that she has, sorry, that he's documented as saying, Cristiano Ronaldo himself, in a conversation with his lawyer, has actually said that she said no several times. She said stop. So this is part of what happened, and he confirmed that in his own words. So, I mean, afterwards, she was in shock, as most survivors are. She didn't know what to do, and she was very intimidated by him. And then when she confided in somebody finally who advised her to go to the hospital and file a police report, you know, everybody's reaction was the same. Oh, but he's so big, he's so powerful, and you'll get lost in this. So coupled with her own trauma and the mounting fear of who he was, because this isn't some two-bit player in a semi-pro league. This is arguably one of the best players and aspiring at that time. So it was, you know, it's pretty mortifying, and she knew what she'd be up against. It didn't help that her first lawyer was not as experienced and couldn't guide her the way that needed to be. But I mean, she was an aspiring actress. She didn't have $20,000 for a retainer. So, I mean, this is part of the problem with the system.
Sure. And this is not the first time that Der Spiegel has written about this. They wrote about this back in 2017. Where has the U.S. media been on this story? This is something that happened in Las Vegas, Nevada. Where have we been on this story?
And I will say this very honestly, is because I'm part of the problem. I'm part of sports media. This has been nowhere. And I absolutely find media and mainstream media, football media particularly, to be complicit in this rape culture, because this is, first of all, not the first time he's ever been implicated in a sexual assault case. The first time was in London in 2005. Barely went anywhere, made no waves. I think I just found a blurb on The Guardian about it when I started this research. Myself and one of my co-hosts, Brenda Elsie, had been talking about this for a long time. We wanted to examine it. We pitched this story to about 16 different outlets and got one yes. So nobody was interested in it. Either they said it's not our beat, or we don't know. The reason football media is reluctant to do this is because, let's not forget that Cristiano Ronaldo has an incredibly powerful PR team. If those particular outlets get cut off from the club or from his representatives, you're in trouble. I mean, he's played for some of the biggest teams in the world.
And that also and that applies to U.S. media, where football slash soccer is not as popular here, I would argue, as maybe regular football or American football. That fear, you think, is applicable here as well?
Absolutely, because I mean, I pitched U.S. outlets. I didn't pitch.
And no one wanted the story.
Nobody wanted the story. And I'm like, how can this not be possible? But this isn't the first time this has happened to me. Same thing with David De Gea, the current goalkeeper for Manchester United, was also just before the Euros implicated in a very brutal rape case, a sexual assault of two workers, sex workers.
Oh, we should also be clear, though, that Ronaldo has responded and denied these allegations, right?
Well, of course he's going to deny them. I mean, he called them fake news. But before he denies them, let's not forget that he paid Catherine Mayorga $375,000 in an NDA. Like, let's not forget that that happened. And she has the documentation. I mean, now she's finally got appropriate legal counsel. But the thing is that Der Spiegel would not, and this is something we have to address when we talk about media, would not have printed this. They've dotted the I's and crossed the T's, and legal has gone over this 100 times. If Cristiano Ronaldo's team was going to sue Der Spiegel, they would have done it a year and a half ago. They haven't even issued a cease and desist. So it's all posturing.
Right. And it also is interesting to me that we are in this moment, this Me Too moment, particularly when it comes, I don't feel that any industry is safe at this point, if you will, quote unquote, safe. I'm surprised that there's been such a real lack of attention to this, given, for example, the Larry Nassar stories that have come out in the sports world and other issues. So I'm really surprised at the lack of attention from the American media here.
I'm not. It was the same thing with David De Gea. And look what happened with Kobe Bryant. He was given basic, you know, a pass by the media, which is complicit in this. I'm not surprised at all, but I'm happy to see that her story is being shared now.
Shireen Ahmed is a freelance sports writer and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Shireen, thanks as always for being with us.
Thanks.
It's been days of horror on the Indonesian island of Sulawesi after an earthquake and tsunami struck over the weekend. Waves as high as 18 feet hit the city of Palu, where hundreds of people were gathered for a beachfront festival. More than 800 people are confirmed dead, and the number is expected to climb. Joining us now is Timothy McLaughlin from The Washington Post, and he's in the city of Makassar, where relief efforts are being coordinated.
Today, I spent a few hours out at the airbase here in Makassar, where there are some military planes, as well as commercial aircraft that people have loaned to be used to fly supplies and people up to Palu now that the airport is at least like partially open. I would say from the few hours that I spent out at the airfield today, the efforts have been a bit chaotic and disorganized. And I think that the people that we interviewed and spoke with today, things have gone a bit slower than they anticipated. We met a few individuals who have been out, you know, sleeping outside of this kind of old airbase since Saturday, trying to make it back. And they've been put on wait lists, but there's been some kind of miscoordination, I think, and some miscommunication over when exactly flights were going to leave and how many people could go on them and how exactly you get your name on the list. So this morning, there was just a couple hundred people kind of crowded outside the gates as names were kind of read aloud through a loudspeaker, people kind of hoping to get onto those flights to get home to find relatives. Most people still having a lot of trouble getting in touch with people from the city due to communications infrastructure being pretty severely damaged. And then in terms of the death toll at the moment, the newest stats from the government put it at 844 people. But the reporting we've done and the understanding is that those deaths are predominantly, if not all, from Palu City. And there has not been counts done of people from outlying areas, from other districts or regencies, rather, that have been impacted. So aid agencies and the government expecting that number to rise significantly, I think, within the next few days.
Can you help us understand exactly what happened? What we're hearing is that there were folks who were gathered in Palu for a beachfront festival, and there were tsunami warnings put out by the government. But was the situation that those warnings were not taken seriously, or were they insufficient?
So I think there's a lot of questions that the government will probably have to answer about that. It seems very unclear at the moment if the tsunami system, there's been a number of issues in the past over the upkeep of the system and funding for it. So yeah, I think, you know, what happened was the original earthquake and then a lag time before the tsunami kind of swept in, and also this very kind of interesting but also devastating phenomenon called liquefaction that you might see some people reporting on and talking about, and the emergency agencies here talking about it. And essentially what happened was like a lot of the loose soil kind of near the top of the ground loses its strength and starts to kind of collapse. So some of the videos you've seen, you know, people have seen kind of going viral, seems like houses are getting kind of swept away, but there's no water there. It's just the land itself is kind of rushing out from underneath them. So a lot of the houses and villages were kind of almost engulfed by the ground itself. I think that's also hampering the relief efforts, is that a lot of this stuff is like quite buried, and a lot of individuals are also buried. So there's some difficulty in getting to those people and to those villages that have kind of almost been like overtaken by the soil almost, as odd as that sounds.
How much is this a reflection of whether or not Indonesia was prepared to deal with a natural emergency of this scale?
You know, the location, you know, on the Ring of Fire, I guess, here is, earthquakes are not, you know, uncommon at all. I think if you pull up some of the, you know, historical maps and some of the ones that have been being posted and passed around, see that there's, you know, huge history of this. So yeah, in these are natural disasters that do happen here with a high frequency. So I think that the government's going to have a lot of questions from the people here over, one, if they're prepared, and two, how they react when these things happen.
Timothy McLaughlin is with The Washington Post, and he joined us from the Indonesian city of Makassar, where relief efforts are being coordinated. Thanks, Timothy.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Starting today, 16-year-olds in New York State will no longer automatically be charged as adults in criminal court, thanks to the so-called Raise the Age legislation passed last year. As a result, 16 and 17-year-olds being detained at New York City's notorious Rikers Island Jail have to be moved out by today. New York and North Carolina were the last two states in the nation to make this change. Here to bring us up to speed on these two huge changes to New York's criminal justice system is our dear friend, Cindy Rodriguez. Cindy covers urban affairs here in our WNYC newsroom, and you've heard her on this show before. Cindy, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tanzina. It's good to be here.
So what exactly are the changes going into effect today? One is regarding housing, and the other one is how the 16-year-olds are being charged, right?
Right, that's correct. So this law will ultimately affect 16 and 17-year-olds, but they're phasing it in. So this is the start of the law. So this is the first phase of the law. So if you're arrested and you're 16 years old today, and it's a misdemeanor crime, your case will automatically go to family court. If it's a felony case, it will go to adult criminal court. Now, there's been a special youth part that's been developed in adult criminal court. If the case involves sexual assault, if it involves any serious physical injury, if it involves a weapon, it will stay in this youth part in adult criminal court. Otherwise, it will go to family court unless a prosecutor claims there's extraordinary circumstances and a judge agrees with that, then the case will stay.
And what about this move that the 16 and 17-year-olds now have to be moved out of Rikers Island, which we know has been the center of so much controversy around just how people have been treated at the facility, et cetera. So is today the day and what's happening?
Yes, that's true, too. So another thing to mention is that this law is not retroactive. So that means if you're already serving a prison sentence, you are staying in state prison. It also means that if you are pretrial, which means that you are currently detained in Rikers Island, and just to give for your national audience a sense of what Rikers Island is, it's the second largest jail system in the country. It's known to be a very violent and chaotic place. So if you are there, that means that you're awaiting trial. You haven't been convicted of anything. Your case will continue through the adult criminal justice system, but you will be moved off the island. And in fact, as of yesterday, I was told that all 93 16 and 17-year-olds that were on Rikers Island are now out of there.
Now, let's talk about where they're going to go.
So they're going to a facility called Horizon. So this is a longstanding juvenile detention facility in the Bronx. And so they've all been moved there.
Now, why this push for this change? I mean, was there something about the way 16 and 17-year-olds in particular were being treated at Rikers? Were they not getting sufficient help? What prompted this this change?
So there's been the law is years in the making, and the backdrop to it is that I believe it was about in 2014 when federal prosecutors started investigating how 16 and 17-year-olds were being treated on Rikers Island, and they found that guards were using excessive force on them. They were striking them in the head repeatedly. They were overusing solitary confinement. And so that was part of the effort to get them off of Rikers Island. In addition to that, we have this young man named Khalif Browder, who was in Rikers in 2010. He was arrested for stealing a backpack. That case was ultimately dismissed, but he stayed there for 3 years. He was in solitary confinement. He was attacked by other inmates and by correction officers, and he was very traumatized by that experience. He was out on his family couldn't meet the $3,000 bail. So when he came out, his story was told by this journalist, Jennifer Gonerman from The New Yorker. It got a lot of attention. Then he started suffering a lot with mental health issues, and ultimately he killed himself. So all of that is sort of the backdrop of where we are today.
And there's been lots of talk, particularly from New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, on a larger plan to essentially shut down Rikers Island. It's complex by 2027. Of course, where all those folks would end up is probably going to be contested very hotly. How does this fit into that larger picture? Is this maybe one of the early steps in shutting down Rikers?
Well, it fits in the sense that in order to close down Rikers, the city needs to drop the population of people that are in jail by about half. They need to drop it to about 5,000. So this is one group of people that are now off Rikers Island. And you mentioned that to move people off the jails is, or to close down Rikers Island is going to be controversial. So the plan is that the city wants to close Rikers Island and then open up new jails in boroughs. So these would be borough-based jails that are more integrated into the community. To do that, they go through sort of a public hearing process. And there's been hearings already in the different neighborhoods where these jails are slotted for, and there's been tremendous opposition so far.
What about, you mentioned Kalief Browder, and I think that that's a fascinating and really important part of this conversation. Is there any talk about ending cash bail as opposed to just moving people in and out?
Right. So there is a whole debate about and an effort to change the way the bail system works in New York. A lot of that change requires action from the state legislator, which seems like it won't happen. There is, though, something pretty interesting that's actually happening today, too, which is there is this mass bailout that's being planned by the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Foundation. And so that mass bailout is targeting 16 and 17-year-olds and women who are incarcerated. That's about 500 people. They were trying to raise $5 million, and the bailouts are supposed to happen throughout the month of October. And today is the first day that we're expected to see some of these people being bailed out.
And I just want to let our listeners know that we did reach out to the mayor's office for comment, and they told us, and we're quoting, "The city is very clear on the ethos of Raise the Age, that kids should be treated as kids. Every part of the planning process has been guided by this principle." Cindy Rodriguez covers urban affairs for WNYC. Thanks for joining us, Cindy.
Thank you, Tanzina.
And that's our show today. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, you can tweet me anytime at Tanzina Vega, or you can tweet us at The Takeaway. We're always looking forward to hearing from you. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. We'll see you tomorrow.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.